Hi, everybody. I'm Justin Vase. I'm a senior fellow at the Center in the U.S. and Europe, and I would like to welcome all of you this morning here at Brookings for a discussion on the impact of the Lisbon Treaty on the European Union. This conference is part of a series that the Heinrich Böll Foundation and the Center in the U.S. and Europe are putting together. I would also like to acknowledge the generous support of the EU delegation here in Washington for our work on Europe and transatlantic relations in general. 3 days ago, the Irish went to the poll to vote in a referendum on whether Ireland should or should not ratify the Lisbon Treaty. They had been asked pretty much the same question a bit more than a year ago and had said no. This time they said yes, which confirms that if you ask a question enough times, you'll eventually get the answer you want. Indeed, the reversal is stunning. On Friday, the yes vote, the yes won by 67% of the vote, with a 59% participation, whereas in June 2008, it had lost by 47% with only a 53% participation. Why the Irish voted this way this time will be my first question to Ambassador Bruton, the former Prime Minister of Ireland. We are lucky to have with us on the panel this morning. I will also ask him in his current capacity as EU ambassador to the US if the Irish vote of Friday seals the deal, if we can be confident that it will actually be implemented, or if there is still some political and institutional suspense left. But before I do so, I would like to offer one short remark. When the Berlin Wall fell 20 years ago and the continent was reunited, the challenge for the European Community, as it was called at the time, was to integrate Central and Eastern European countries without losing its momentum and agility. In other words, a debate between enlarging first or deepening and reforming first. The result was more than a decade of debates and controversies about EU institutions, starting with the Nice Treaty of 2001, including the ill-fated EU Constitution, which is, as you know, a precursor to the Lisbon Treaty and which was voted down by France and the Netherlands in 2005. It is hard to dispute that this was, if not a lost decade, at least a time of navel-gazing and introversion, keeping the EU from realizing its full potential in the world. Well, the Irish vote of Friday turns this page, and I think we should keep in mind that behind the technical aspects of the treaty, it is a truly historical moment, a genuine turning point that we are witnessing. But of course, how far-reaching a turning point will largely depend on the way the Lisbon Treaty is implemented. And to discuss these questions, we have assembled a first-rate panel, which I will briefly introduce. After Ambassador Bruton, Federica Bindi, my colleague here at Brookings and also an advisor to the Italian Minister of Foreign Affairs, will give us her perspective on what comes next. Then I will ask Ralph Fuchs from the Heinrich Böll Foundation, who is the president of the Heinrich Böll Foundation in Berlin, to reflect on what the Lisbon Treaty means for democracy in the EU and also to give us a German perspective. Then on the international and transatlantic impact of the treaty, I will ask first Timothy Garton-Hash here on my right, who is a professor of European Studies at the University of Oxford and also a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and then Charlie Kupchen, a professor of international affairs at Georgetown and a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. I will ask them both to give us their perspective. So without further ado, Ambassador Bruton, thanks for... I think we can stay here if that's fine with you so as to avoid the maneuvering around the podium. So this is the last few weeks we have you here in Washington with us, and the Washington foreign policy community is definitely losing a precious element with your departure at the end of the month. So thanks again for being with us, and I have three questions for you. Why did the Irish vote yes this time? Can we assume that the Lisbon Treaty will actually go into effect? And then more generally, why is this victory so significant?
Well, To give a good answer to the question as to why the Irish people changed their mind, I needed to draw on people who were participating in the campaign. And I'm very glad that we have here present somebody whom I discussed this morning, Marion Harkin, who's a member of the European Parliament for Connacht Ulster. And Marion tells me that the important reasons contributing to the change were, one, the anxiety that Irish people have about their economic situation, and in particular, I suppose, the very large guarantees to the banks that the Irish government has had to give in order to not only preserve the Irish, but also, I think, the interrelated European banking system. Secondly, the important guarantees that were obtained by the Irish government on matters such as there being no interference with the freedom of countries to settle their own tax policies, the neutrality of the country being something it would have the option to preserve, and also the fact that every country will continue to have a commissioner. And you can understand that for an island off the mainland of Europe, having somebody at the heart all the time is an important consideration. I think it's fair to say also that the campaign was more united and more focused this time on the part of the major parties and of civil society. The useful statement was issued, I think, by the Irish Catholic bishops and the Irish Farming Organisation. It's also interesting to analyse where the swing was pretty uniform across the country, 20 points of a swing right across the board. Obviously, just as there were more no's the last time in less well-off areas than there were in better-off areas, they still had a slightly higher no proportion, but the swing was the same, 20 points across the board, with two slight divergences. One was Donegal, which is in the northwest of the country and very much influenced by Northern Ireland, where the swing was only 13 points. And the other was in Westminster, in North Kerry, West Limerick and Cork North West, which are very strong dairy farming constituencies, which I think suggests an important influence of the farming leadership in bringing about a yes vote. As to what happens now, well, clearly it's a matter now for the remaining countries to decide on the ratification. I understand there's an issue in Finland to do with the Åland Islands. There is an issue as well in regard to the signature of the president being affixed to the document in the Czech Republic and in Poland. In both cases, and all three cases, this is a matter for the constitutional procedures in each of those countries to be followed. The European Union is and seeks to be an ever closer union, but it is a union of sovereign states. And when it comes to ratifying treaties, each country decides on their own procedure for themselves as to how ratification should take place. And the union respects that. This is a union of 27 sovereign nations working together voluntarily under agreed legal agreements. And it is unique in the world in that regard. It's the only example, as I've said here before, of a multinational democracy in the entire world. And it's a voluntary democracy at that. So I'm very proud of it. But I think proud us all and all as one has to be of the European Union, one has to have patience with it because of its very nature, being one that obligates us to move rather more slowly than sometimes our friends would wish us to move.
And do you have probably for you, capping this long-standing functions you've had here in Washington with a victory and must be motive for joy, I guess.
Well, of course, I'm absolutely delighted, but I suppose I'm even more relieved than delighted because the thought of coming here, and I accepted your invitation long before I knew the result, the thought of coming here and having to explain what had happened if Ireland had voted no wasn't a very enticing or appetizing one. And I do think as well, I hope that the remaining countries are able to ratify, that it will take this issue of treaty change off the agenda for a considerably long time and will enable us to devote all our energies in Europe now to the issue that's important to Europeans, which is restoring the dynamism of our economies, investing in research and development, developing a common rather than a differentiated energy policy, having a united approach to the management of the single currency. We are committed in the Lisbon Treaty, or sorry, in the Maastricht Treaty, to conducting our economic policies, each of us, with a view to the interests of all the other members. And it's very important that the energies of our political leadership be devoted to getting a united approach and implementing it on economic revival, on energy, on cross-border crime, and on all those other things that would be greatly facilitated by the passage of the Lisbon Treaty.
Thanks very much. Federica, so what comes next? Tell us a bit about the politics of the implementation of the Lisbon Treaty, starting maybe with a sort of challenge to you. What are the main points of the Lisbon Treaty? What substantially does it change for Europe?
Okay, so you double challenge me. You're not making me talking standing up. I'll try to be easy because in reality it's very complicated what we will change. Now, what you all know that is with the Lisbon Treaty, we're going to have a sort of European foreign minister, which is actually the high representative, and we're going to have a president. So the first thing that, in American terms, you should not do is thinking, oh, wow, you're going to have a secretary of state and a president like yours. Nope, forget. That is not the way it works. So on one side, we'll have more unity and more representativity, but on the other side, this is more complicated than it seems. And I'll go back into the details. There are two things which really matters to an American audience is that the European Union is going to have an enhanced common foreign security policy and a European defense policies. All right. Now, without getting into what that means in concrete terms. In concrete terms, it means that common foreign security policy did already exist, but it was what we called a second pillar, intergovernative policy. This policy will be moved into the so-called first pillar. It will become a communitarized pillar. Why is that? Because finally, the juridical personality will not be of European communities anymore, but of the European Union. Because so far, we have European communities and the European Union, which are somehow interconnected. Okay? Which, in principle, would mean, wow, the foreign ministers are going to decide at the majority voting, and the high representative will have a possibility to decide and be proactive like Secretary of State. No, this is not the case. How actually will work? It is a matter of negotiation today because the treaty says that there are these two figures, but they don't say exactly what they're going to do and what kind of role they have. So what is going on under, I must say, a very, very active Swedish presidency is that basically the permanent representative are meeting every day in Brussels trying to define the commas of what is going to happen. Now, the first question is the president. Is it going to be a chair or is it going to be a leading political personality? Given that we don't have, given a few exceptions, but we don't have leading political personality, at least in the Obama sense in Europe, of course, the one who becomes a president of the European Union expects to have some sort of leadership. But the real negotiations are now on the foreign minister, the high representative. The high representative will be in charge to enact the European foreign policy given the guidelines of the European Council. So the first thing which will actually happen is that the head of states and government will have a leading role, an enhanced leading role in foreign policy. This is something that has been happening in Europe since, I would say, the 1990s, foreign policy has been less and less in the hands of the foreign minister, more and more in the hands of the heads of states and governments. So this process will be enhanced by the Lisbon Treaty, and somehow we will come to a situation which is very similar to the U.S. in terms of division of competencies. Now, the second question is, how the councils will be divided. We now have, within the Council of Ministers, we have a council which is the General Affairs and External Relations Council, where the Minister of Foreign Affairs sit, and which is headed by, chaired by the rotating president, which, as you know, rotates every 6 months. Now, this council will be divided, as it used to be before, so we'll have a General Affairs Council where the foreign ministers will sit, and which will be chaired here, by the rotating presidency. So the fact that we have a president doesn't mean that we will get rid of this system of rotating presidency. And we will have an External Relations Council, which will be headed by the High Representative. Now, the bulk of negotiations today is what goes under the competencies of External Relations Council and what goes under the General Affairs. You would say, who cares? Of course, the member states care. So to give you an idea of how complex this is, Article 133 policies are going to be, which is commercial policies, are going to be under the External Relations Council. But there will be a permanent delegation that any time you will be discussing about issues in commercial policy, the chair will move from the High Representative to the foreign minister in charge of rotating presidency. We often say that in Europe we discuss tomatoes and potatoes. That is what is happening, only because tomatoes and potatoes are important. Another issue of relevance is where is development policies going to be? Are they going to be under external relations or are they going to be under general affairs? Now, to any rational mind, they would go under external relations. But you have lot at stake there. So now their member states, our ambassadors, are fighting in Brussels where to put it. And on one side you have the pro-European countries, like the Benelux countries, which wanted to go into the hands of external relations. They are those which want to enhance the external High Representative. On the other side, you have the less pro-European countries, which are saying, no, we want it on the general affairs. And in the middle, you have a number of different policies. So at least a number of different countries. So at least in the beginning, it will be very difficult for the machine to move. So don't expect that, assuming that the treaty comes into force on the 1st of January, because the date which was initially foreseen, the 1st of November, is unthinkable now. So on the 1st of January, don't think all of a sudden Europe will wake up and have a real foreign policy. It will take a lot. Plus, you have a number of questions. The High Representative is one. What if he needs to be substituted? Who is going to substitute him? Is it going to be the minister, foreign minister of a rotating presidency? Is it going to be an official from the External Relations Service? These are all questions which might seem less important, but are very important because those who will represent him. Do we have vice High Representative? Who they are? It's quite important. Who defines the Council President's program? The rotating president together with the High Representative and the chair or not? So it is quite complicated how it is going to be designed. The other issue which we are discussing now is the European Diplomatic Service, which of course we don't call the Diplomatic Service because some countries are too sensible for that, so we call it the External Relations Action Service. And I must say I never thought about being a diplomat, but if I were, I would be very excited now, because this is going to be one of the interesting things. The member states, you will have people coming from the Commission, people coming from the Council, and people coming from the member states. So, for instance, in my country, Italy, we are thinking about organizing a diplomatic concours every year, and for the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to have 10 extra people being hired, 35 instead of 25 each year, because we will have to devote part of the forces to external service. But again, it's not clear. Are these people going to spend all their time within the EU diplomatic service, or are they going to go back after a while? These are all questions which are for the time being, and these people are going to matter, because these people are going to share. You know that you have a council and you have the ministers, and now underneath you have the working groups. These people will be chairing all the working groups which falls under the External Relations Council, which currently are chaired by people coming from the rotating presidency. So we are talking about nominating people, but the question is, do we want people which afterwards relates to the member states or not? Now, another major innovation will be defense policy. Defense policy came little by little into the European Union life and will become a policy of its own. So this is a big innovation. The so-called Petersburg task, which is a set of security and defense policies, will be enhanced. So now the EU will be able to act both in civil and military terms to implement, to accomplish the Petersburg task. This, of course, if we have the real capability to do that. And there is also the possibility for a selected number of states to act in the field of defense to enact one action on the other. We have something similar under the PESD. For instance, we have something in Congo, which was led by France. We had something in Guinea-Bissau, which was led by Portugal. We are now discussing about having something under PESD in Somalia, which would be eventually led by Italy. But this is going to be an act. So the first time you really have a European defense policy. And you're going to have also a European defense agency, which is going to deal with research, military capacity, and all this sort of stuff. Now, another thing which stems out of this is that Article 42 foreseen the fact that member states are now, well, will be now, binded by mutual assistance in case of attack in their territory. Something similar to what we have in Article 5 under NATO. At that point, it means until now, there was another treaty which only included 10 member states, which was the WEO, which had this provision. Now, the moment that the Treaty of the European Union is entering into force, the WTO, which really never did much, is completely ceasing to exist. But to give you an idea of how discussion is that, and the Secretary General, I'm finishing, the Secretary General, which is currently Xavier Solana, will expire on November 26. Now, any rational person would say, okay, you have a new treaty with a new article, the Secretary General expiring, the WEO that basically doesn't exist anymore, we dismiss it. No, because we have an assembly of the Western European Union, which is formed by national parliamentarians of the 10 member states plus other 17 observers, and they meet twice in Paris a year. I mean, do you want to take away from our MEPs the pleasure of going twice to Paris for, you know, high-level important things? And you know what they invented? They invented that, you know, we can't dismiss the assembly because that would create a democratic deficit. What are you talking about? So, but that gives you a little bit, you know, the petty disputes which are going on. Right now. Last thing, very quickly, and we can go back to that. Who's going to do what? Which is a big question. The two major positions are, of course, the EU president and the secretary and the EU external representative. The EU president, and we have already selected two people. The president of the European Commission, Barroso, was re-elected, was confirmed, I mean, you know. Exactly. He doesn't do any harm, and this is why he was... Well, he does do harm by not doing any harm, but that's my view. And so he was unenthusiastically re-elected, and we had this glorious Barroso II program. Wow. And we had the president of the European Parliament, which was elected, which is a Polish. So you have a Portuguese Christian Democrat and a Polish Christian Democrat is there, and you have you also have to take into consideration that a Danish Secretary General of NATO was elected, a Norwegian Secretary General of the Council of Europe was elected. So all these things are related. So who are you going to have? One is Tony Blair. He was unimpressive in his quarter to job, so it seems to be left out because of that. Felipe González is really hoping to become the new, he's now the head of this faction group, he's really hoping to become the next president, it could be. Some are saying, talking about Pat Cox, I don't know if you know anything about that, the former president of the parliament. Actually, I hope Pat Cox will not be elected because I would like you to see in the place of a high representative, which of course you won't comment, I know it, but... But Carl Bildt, which was a very good candidate, looks unlikely. And the same things seems to me, as our only rent, because you would have too many Nordics in top position, but there are two of them among. Frattini was mentioned by the Polish, and his secretary almost had a heart attack because she doesn't speak English or French, and I had lots of fun in telling him, you know, Franco might be going to Brussels. He's like, don't tell me that, but I don't think he's interested in the job. So this is really an open question, and I wonder if any of you really have any input from that point of view. I've been trying to sneak in other information, but I'm not really successful.
Thanks. I should add, you're probably not in favor of Frattini, right?
Well, you know,
okay, I'm sorry.
I would actually love Frattini to go there, because then that would be the time I would go to Brussels, actually.
Right. Ralph, I would have two questions for you. One relates to democracy. Is this second vote a victory or a defeat for European democracy, I would say? And second, if you can spare a few minutes to talk about Germany in particular after the results of the 27th of September elections, is that a second victory for Angela Merkel?
Okay, thanks. Maybe we could start with the latter issue and then quick return to the European affairs again. Of course, it's a victory for Angela Merkel to be re-elected, and especially she's the first German chancellor after the Second World War who managed to be re-elected in a new coalition. She changed coalition. But I would say it was a kind of Pyrrhus victory. If you are looking to the numbers of the Christian Democrats over the last elections, you have a steady decline. Although Angela Merkel personally is quite popular, well-respected, has a lot of authority across parties in Germany, but she acted as a chancellor more as a kind of president, a non-partisan politician, and this was the way she ran the campaign too. And to say it a little bit with a little dose of irony, I would say it was another proof that large part of the German society desires to have social democratic government by a conservative chancellor. So don't misread these elections. This was not a sharp move to a right-wing or neoliberal agenda. Although the liberals, which ran with a, let's say, soft neoliberal agenda, are now part of the government, but don't expect major changes both in terms of domestic and international policies of Germany. And maybe the most interesting thing is that this election was another step in a very long-term development, a kind of erosion, a meltdown of the former Volksparteien, the Social Democrats and the Christian Democrats. In the 70s, in Western Germany, these two major parties gained about 90% of the votes in the elections. And then we had, in these times, we had participants of around about 90% of the population, of the citizens. And now they are down to 57%, and the former small parties, the Liberals, the Greens, and the left socialists, the post-communists, are close to 40%. So you have a real new political landscape in Germany, much more plural, much more diverse, reflecting the growing social and cultural diversity of the society. And I don't expect that we will have a kind of return to this classical left camp, right camp polarization in the political system, although there is some risk that things will go for some years in that way, which I personally would find quite unfortunate, because I don't think that really major reforms fundamentally changes which are needed in different dimensions are really possible in such a polarization mode. So I expect more continuity than changes in German politics, but of course there are some hard to predict developments ongoing. We have this dramatic increase in public debt, which in Europe and especially in Germany is another thing than in the USA. You are still quite confident that you can grow out public debt. That's not the case in Europe and especially not the case in Germany, against the background of demographic change and a shrinking and eldering society. So public debt is a huge problem which the new government has to fight with. We are still not out of the economic crisis. Unemployment will rise. And the promise of tax cuts, which has been the common political promise of the liberals and the Christian Democrats, there is very, very little space to do that. It will be the other way around. The new government will have cut spending and will have increased funds. So we will face interesting times, maybe to the consequences on foreign policies and transatlantic relations. We will have the opportunity to come back to that later. So, but now to... maybe a last sentence to the Greens, because I'm representing the Green Political Foundation. We never have been so disappointed about a reasonable success, you know, growing to 10.7% of the votes, being in a lot of major cities, the third party, very close to the Social Democrats, up to 20% and more, but without a governmental option. And we will have to look over the next years to change that. So European democracy, that's, you know, a very tricky thing because of this extremely complex and very specific character of the European Union. In the two comments of my predecessors, you already learned, if you are not anyway experts in the European Union, how strange that construction of the European Union is, maybe from an American perspective. It's still very much a multi level, multipolar institution with a complex balance of powers. And John Bruton highlighted in his initial statement the character of the European Union as a union of European states. Okay, that's true to a certain some extent, but of course that's not all. By far, that's not the whole picture. At the same time, the EU is a kind of union of citizens, represented by the European Parliament, which is constituted by directly elected representatives. So, in terms of democratization, I think the Lisbon Treaty will bring some substantial improvements. It will upgrade the position of the European Parliament in terms of co-decision. But still, the European Parliament is far away from a full-fledged legislative body. It doesn't have the right of political initiatives. the real legislation of the European Union is the European Council, so the Council of the Member States. And the initiative right goes with the European Commission. So again, this is an illustration that we should not look at the European Union as a kind of enlarged national state. That's not the case at all, and that will not be the case for the medium and maybe for the longer future, but still it's more than just a union of states. The Lisbon Treaty, in addition to that, will introduce a new instrument of European Citizens' Initiative. This will give a little bit more space for civil society initiatives on a European level. 2 million European citizens signing a kind of petition will have the opportunity to put a political issue on the agenda of the Commission and the Parliament, but not to decide on it, of course. And it will, which is quite interesting, to strengthen the role of national parliaments vis-à-vis their national governments. So national parliaments will be more involved in the process of decision-making by the European Council. But at the end, we will even have more these complicated checks and balances, and I guess that decision-making will not become really more effective and more uncomplicated. Also, we will have more political issues decided by a simple majority in the European Council.
Thanks. Do you have a last word on this, Ralf?
Okay. I'm fine with that. Maybe just a final deliberation. There is a feeling in the European public that at the same time we have more and more decisions on the European level, but the lack of democratic control and influence by the European public, and that will be an issue over the next decade. Yeah.
Thanks very much. Now I'm going to turn to my colleagues and friends, Timothy and Charlie Kupchan, to ask them about, you know, one of the big innovations of the Lisbon Treaty is, as Federica described, the fact that it will be better represented abroad and probably more effective in its dealings with the rest of the world. And so I'd like to ask both of them questions about this more specifically. Timothy described in several of his Guardian columns the fact that the EU often resembled more a greater Switzerland than a world power like China or the U.S. And so the obvious questions that comes to mind that I would put to him is, will these changes help the EU become less of a greater Switzerland and more of a world power? And Timothy, if I may, if you could also spare a few minutes to address the situation in the UK. There's considerable concern among EU circles that David Cameron's Tories will either undo the Lisbon Treaty when they come to power, or that they will somehow undermine the EU. So I would have a side question, which is how worried should we be? And then if you could move to the question of EU as a global power.
Thank you, Justin. Well, I think that getting our act together in foreign policy is one of the five most important things that Europe has to do in the next decade, and possibly the most important. And the Lisbon Treaty and the institutional changes are clearly a necessary but by no means a sufficient condition for doing that. Without the political will of the member states, particularly of the larger and medium-sized member states, but actually of the member states to core, you won't have a European foreign policy with the best possible machinery. So actually the question about Britain is not so much of a side issue after all. I'm afraid the news is we have a British problem. Again, or still, or however you want to put it. Because you cannot make an effective European foreign policy without active participation by Britain. But Britain's likely next Prime Minister, David Cameron, and the British Conservatives do not want an effective European foreign policy. That is very clear. He is Eurosceptic. The likely Foreign Secretary, William Hague, is Eurosceptic. The Parliamentary Party is Eurosceptic. The new likely intake of MPs are Eurosceptic. Grandchildren of Margaret Thatcher. The Conservative press is Eurosceptic and therefore influencing the Conservative public. That's a real problem for people like me. That's a lot to be up against. So that, frankly, analytically, I think this will be one of the major obstacles for the next few years in making a European foreign policy. Are there any reasons to be slightly less pessimistic? Well, number one, nothing in politics is certain. I think it would be something close to a miracle if Gordon Brown won the election. I would bet a very large, and so several magnums of champagne, that he won't. But it is more possible, if you look at the electoral arithmetic, that we would have a hung parliament. In one possible constellation, that would mean that the Conservatives depended to some extent on the Liberal Democrats for forming a government. That is to say, the most pro-European party in British politics and the most anti-European would be strange bedfellows. That would change the balance somewhat. How it would work, don't ask me. Number two, realism. In the end, British conservatives are also realists. And the story of the last 50 years has been that when conservatives get into government and face the realities of making foreign policy, then they realize that they can't achieve their goals without, at least in part, working with European partners, particularly if, like David Cameron, you're concerned with big global issues like climate change. Third reason for, as it were, modified pessimism or very cautious optimism is actually not in Europe at all. It's just down the road in Washington. What is the most important single factor that will influence David Cameron's position on this question? It is the attitude of the United States. And if Barack Obama says to David Cameron, and I hope he will, in the most emphatic terms, we, the United States, want to work with a united Europe in making foreign policy. We love you dearly. We have great sentimental ties. We like coming to Westminster and going to Windsor Castle and Oxford and so on, but so far as the real business of foreign policy is concerned, we want to work with the European Union, and says that very emphatically, I think that would have a major, perhaps the most important impact on conservative policy. I think it's the single most important a factor that would change their position. Can I just add one word about the machinery of making European foreign policy, which Federica talked about. And I can put this somewhat provocatively like this. I don't want Tony Blair to be the so-called president of the European Union. And I don't want Tony Blair to be the so-called president of the European Union, not because I don't admire Tony Blair, because actually I do very much genuinely admire Tony Blair, but because I want the spotlight to be on the High Representative. The High Representative is the key to creating an effective European foreign policy. The so-called president, I emphasize so-called, it's a misnomer. The European Union already has two presidents who are not in fact presidents. The last thing we need is a third. President in this case is a kind of, if I may say so, Justin, a mistranslation from the French. You are, as we know in French, the president of this session, but you are not, I think, our president. In other words, what this office actually is a chair. What we need is a strong, significant, consensus-building chair, not someone who wants to strut and fret upon the world stage. I think it's a significant job, but I want it to be a strong chair. The High Representative is a key post for making a European foreign policy, and here I would like to see a real big hitter who has a double task. The first is to shape something that does not exist, which is the apparatus for making European foreign policy. And it's technical stuff, as you'll have gathered from Federica, but it's very important how you make the European External Action Service. Does it get good people? What are their powers? Does it control one of the biggest aid budgets in the world? How does it relate to enlargement policy, competition policy, trade policies? These are very important issues to which there will be huge bureaucratic resistance in Brussels. At the same time, someone to whom President Obama or Premier Wen Jiabao will actually want to pick up the telephone, someone who is a significant enough political figure to play on the world stage. So if you want me to name a name, I mean, I'd love to have Carl Bildt, but I think the Scandinavian issue has been mentioned, and possibly Carl himself does not always, how shall we put it, suffer fools gladly in all contexts, which may be a disadvantage in this case. But for example, someone like Joschka Fischer, who has constantly insisted he doesn't want a job, which is usually a good indication that someone does, would, I think, be a terrific person. You know, a German from a big country, a big hitter, someone who can knock heads together both in Brussels and in the world outside. It may not be Joschka, but someone of that type. But my key point is, if we really want to create a European foreign policy over the next 3, 4, 5 years, and it will take that long, the spotlight should be on the High Representative, not the soi-disant president.
Thanks very much, Timothy. Charlie, last word is yours. So same question. Do these changes that the Lisbon Treaty will bring make the emergence of Europe as a world power more likely? And the other question I would have for you is, what do you think will be the impact on transatlantic relations?
As the final speaker, I'll try to summarize a little bit what I've heard on the panel. And the short answer to your question is, we don't know what impact Lisbon will have. And I think we don't know because there are two contradictory forces at play in Europe today. One I would call the forces of aggregation, and that's represented by Lisbon. And the other, the forces of renationalization, which is that politics in Europe of late, the last 5 years or so, has been going downward, not upward. Mm-hmm. Politics has been getting more national and less European, and indeed more local and less national. And so I think that the big question is, of these two forces, which will win out, which will end up over this coming decade be more powerful? And I would say, if I had to put money on it, that the forces of aggregation may just edge out the forces of renationalization, but I'm more worried about it today than at any point in my career as an observer of Europe. So let me back up a little bit and talk a little bit about those two contradictory tendencies. I think if you take Lisbon at face value, it could prove to be as I think you put it in your opening remarks, a turning point, in that if you think historically about either states or unions, they hit this moment when they go through a period of institutional centralization And that moment then enables them to do things externally that they could never do before. So in the case of the United States, we were arguably a great power by the 1870s, 1880s, but we didn't translate those resources into external ambition until the late 1890s. And that occurred because the institutions of governance in the United States became centralized. Power shifted from the states to the federal government and from Congress to the so-called imperial presidency. And once that happened, we could build a high seas fleet. We could send the Great White Fleet abroad. We could engage in World War I. We could never do that without those institutional changes. I think you could make the same argument about England. England became a great power only as a result of the English Civil Wars, which enhanced the role of Parliament, created the post of Prime Minister, merchant marine became part of the state apparatus. And so you can go through and find these moments when the light bulb goes on. Institutions centralize, and then political actors have the wherewithal to assert themselves. So that's one reading of what's happening in Europe today, that this moment could be the counterpart of the 1890s in the United States. The reason that I worry about that is that, as I said, I think beneath the surface, politics has been going in the opposite direction, that European political debate isn't animated by the European project in the way that it used to be. It's much more about national issues. Look at the recent German election. It was all about kind of taxation and issues very much about Europe and very little about, about Germany, and almost nothing about Europe or beyond Europe. And I think that this is not just a passing phenomenon, that there has been a kind of turning inward of European politics that's stemming from the enlargement fatigue, Muslim immigration, globalization, lots of different things, but it's pushed politics downward. And I wonder, maybe I'll throw this to the European panel, since I'm the only American up here, is the traditional European model of integration losing steam? And that model of integration seems to me to be that Europe has always been about geopolitics, but geopolitics has been hidden behind economic integration. And so the first move was the coal and steel community, but it wasn't about coal and steel. It was about preventing war between France and Germany, but you had to hide it in economic integration. And I would say the same thing from there onward, that EPC, EDC stalled because Europeans weren't ready to get it together on geopolitics, so instead they integrated the single market, the single currency, and the geopolitical issues were hiding behind them. Now, it seems to me the geopolitical issues are on the agenda. As you put it, perhaps it's the most important issue for the EU to get its act together. But I'm not sure Europeans want to do that. And so when you change the narrative of Europe from single market and single currency to projecting European power abroad, it's not clear to me that you're going to win over votes and citizens and leaders. So to sum up, I would say that I'm going to remain somewhat agnostic about what is going to happen over the next decade. I think it's entirely plausible that despite Lisbon, we will end up in the year 2020 with a British Europe, a Europe that is primarily a Europe of nation states in which there hasn't been the aggregation of capability that many of us would like to see. And I don't think that that's a disaster. It's fine. I just, as someone who's pro-European, would be disappointed because I think the world desperately needs Europe. The U.S. is in trouble up to its eyeballs, right? We are going to, come hell or high water, retrench over the coming decade. And it seems to me if we're going to solve climate change, if we're going to pacify Afghanistan, if we're going to deal with development in Africa, the world desperately needs a Europe that aggregates its capability. Because otherwise Europe is going to gradually fall off the radar screen. Germany alone, Britain alone, France alone just isn't big enough to cut it. And so I hope that Lisbon turns into the Europe that I think many of us hope it will. I fear that it might not.
Timothy?
Just a quick comment on what Charlie said, which I totally agree with. By the way, I think a British Europe would be very bad for Britain, apart from anything else. You are right. There has been a renationalization of European politics, and the most important example of that is Germany. 20, 30, 40 years ago, the great motor of European integration. Now, if you look at the positions Angela Merkel takes, they're quite different from those taken by Helmut Kohl. Much more willing to talk very explicitly about German national interests, for example, in the energy relationship with Russia. Someone put it rather well. They said, the Federal Republic today is a second France, i.e., putting your own national interests first. Why I think this is not necessarily the end of the game is for the following simple reason. Most of the national interests of most European countries, most of the time, are actually very similar in today's world. So even if you start from a cold analysis of your national interests, you can arrive quite calmly at a position where you need to pool your resources, which is actually what France classically has done and what Germany and Britain could do. And if it works, that will be how it works, because starting from the analysis of national interests, you reach the conclusion that you do need to aggregate, to pool your resources, and you need the mechanism to aggregate.
Ambassador Bruton, you had a...
I was about to agree with what Timothy has just gone and said. I think that even historically, I would say to Charles, that the aggregating forces in Europe were always internally driven. Avoiding a war between France and Germany was an internal issue in Europe. Creating a single currency was an internal issue in Europe because of the suffering from the variations of currencies that had occurred before and the need to create a zone of stability. And if we're looking for the forces that will drive aggregation in the future, I think energy dependence on Russia is one. Climate change is driven, the fact that Europe is taking a lead on climate change is in part driven by a need to try to minimize that external dependence. I think managing the euro is going to become quite a challenge because there is a risk as the global imbalances are sorted out that the euro could be into an appreciation relative to other currencies, which could be very difficult for a Europe that needs to promote its exports, and that will have to be managed. Likewise, I think cross-border crime, or most crimes internally committed in Europe now have a cross-border element, so we would be required, if we're to have open countries in Europe, which I think we're going to continue to have common approaches to crime and common approaches to immigration. So I think all of the factors that will actually drive us towards having a common external policy are in fact going to be internal and national interest-based, to use Timothy's phrase.
Thanks. Fed?
Just a couple of comments. First, on Charlie, the traditional model of integration is losing ground. Not actually, in the sense that this balance and contradiction between intergovernmental and integrationist forces have always been there. So it's nothing new under the sun. It's only that we have more states. But the system is always the same. The second comment would be that I couldn't agree more with what Timothy said. And on the high representative, I think that everybody's agreeing on what you say, at least at European level. And the proof is that in these very tight negotiations that are taking place in Brussels, there are all concentrating on the high representative and external relations. There is, from what I see, there is basically nothing on the president. So I think, that the chair is one of them, a prestigious chair in that sense. Tony Blair would be perfect because, like he did with the quartet, prestigious chair did nothing. So, and the external service will be the key. Now, from that point of view, my hopes are really high. Because one of the forces which actually draining Europe backwards are, with all due respect, diplomats. They're very jealous of the national prerogative. I'm going to share this little this little working group, you share this other one. Then we have the fights among European diplomats on these petty, stupid issues. It's huge. Now, the moment we start to have a European external service and a part of our national diplomats will be spending a substantial part, if not all part, of their life in Brussels, I think this is going to be a turnaround. Together with the fact that the new generation is coming, is beginning. I mean, in here, we are all relict of the Cold War. But when I look at my students, for my students, in whatever their family situation, social situation, whatever, Europe is a fact. You know, the fact that when they go to another European country, they have to change money, it's something that doesn't even cross their minds. The fact that you have to present documents, it doesn't cross their minds. So I think that all these factors together, we might have a difficulty now because we don't have a real leader. But I think that in long term, the construction, we want to have a British English, we'll have a European British.
Thanks. Ralph, do you
three want? Short comments. First, on the issue of renationalization or continued aggregation. Timothy, I would say it's not only a legitimate, but maybe necessary argument to build up support, political support for European integration. To say that the EU, or the transnational cooperation and integration, is in the very national interest of the European states, and that the European Union is just about the added value of cooperation in a more and more globalized world where the challenges Europe is facing are beyond the leverage of the single nation states. So I don't think there is a basic contradiction between this reference to national interest and political and continuing this momentum of cooperation and European integration. And John Bruton was very right that this history of the European Union is very much about building common institutions to deal with common problems, starting with this European Union for coal and steel, which, as was said, was very much a political project to overcome the hostility between Germany and France, the single European market, the single currency. So, and I would ask, what next? What is the next big political project for Europe? The Lisbon Treaty, isn't it? It's just a kind of skeleton, just a political mechanism. But that's not the project to gain support, to engage the European public, and to create dynamics for more cooperation and integration. I would guess it should be very much related to energy policies in terms of energy security, but of course, talking from a green perspective, in terms of greening the European energy system and the European industry, and making Europe to the most advanced pioneer of a sustainable energy system based on renewable energies. And if we want to achieve such kind of really ambitious and challenging goals, we can't only do it by more cooperation on the European level. And the last point, I see the most critical potential conflict between two camps, political camps in Europe. One, putting a clear priority on deepening integration. And the other one, trying to keep some dynamics and speed in the process of enlargement. And that comes back to the catchword of geopolitics. And I'm most afraid about that kind of enlargement fatigue in the European institutions and also in the European public. neglecting the political necessity to provide a reliable European perspective to the Western Balkans, to Turkey, to Ukraine, to Georgia, or to these countries in the neighborhood of the European Union, which otherwise will fall into the political hegemony of Russia again, or will, like Turkey, then start a kind of Schaukelpolitik, balancing between Europe, Islamic world, Russia, and so on and so forth. So I would say Europe still has a political mission of a really high importance to create stability, democracy and security in our neighborhood by continuing our enlargement policies. And this will be the biggest challenge for the next two decades.
Thanks. Before we get to the question and answers question, Ambassador Bruton, you had a word?
Well, could be the first question. I was interested in the decision of the German Constitutional Court, which put certain limits on the further development of the European Union, because it took the view that at European Union-wide level, the European Union was insufficiently democratic. And it said that it felt that there was an irreconcilable tension between the equality of states, which is inherent in a treaty-based organization, and more democracy. Now, on that, I just don't agree with them. I think that we already have developed, as has been said, a substantial democracy at the level of the European Union through the European Parliament. And I think we could go further by electing some of the presidents directly by the people rather than having them selected by heads of government. And I think that the German Constitutional Court's concerns about European-level democracy could be dealt with. But I wonder, this is the question I'd ask Ralph, what is the likelihood that that jurisprudence is likely to change in the future? Is it like this country, where the composition of the court can tilt matters in one direction or the other over time, or is this likely to remain a fixed position in light of the rights of the lander who originally agreed to the basic law?
Thanks. I suggest that, Ralph, you keep that question in mind, and we open the floor to your questions. We're going to take three questions in a row, so this time we're going to take only two. So make sure to introduce yourself before you ask the question, and make sure there's a question mark at the end of your sentence, please. Sir.
Thank you. My name is Thomas Kostas from Ludwig Maximilians University in Munich. I have a question about the integration. If you ask me to draw a graph of integration, I would say it's going up to the upper right corner. And sometimes there may be a level where it stays the same for some time. But I want to ask you, on the possibilities of spillbacks in the EU, do you think that is possible, or is it just a myth? Thank you.
Thanks. One other question. Julius, here.
Thank you. Julius Friend. Since Ireland has been guaranteed a commissioner, does that mean that all of the other small states will have one and we'll still be with 27?
Thanks. So we're going to take this round of questions. Maybe we could start with, why don't you start, Ralph, the question that Ambassador Bruton put to you?
Yeah, very short answer to a long story. I would predict that the main consequence of the sentence of the Constitutional Court in Germany will be that the national parliament has to be much more involved in European decision-making, especially when it comes to additional transfer of decision rights, a transfer of political sovereignty from the national to the European level. Because maybe the core of this rule of the court was that still the European Union is not a full-fledged democracy, so you have to keep some prerogatives which secure that all political decisions at last are under the sovereignty of the elected representatives of the population. And, of course, that's a very, I would say, conservative, structurally conservative attitude, and it now is questioned. We have a very vivid debate in Germany on that for the first time for a long time, but I don't think that will be the lot worse. But what I agree with that we have to be very aware of these issues of political legitimacy if we don't want to lose the support of the European peoples on the way to a more integrated European Union.
Thanks. And I guess the question is more generally one of federalism. And here in this country, of course, whether with the Electoral College or with the Senate, we have the same questions of contradiction of how much to power to give to the states, even very small one with 400,000 people or 500,000 people compared to 36 million people like California and the inherent contradiction with the democratic principle. Maybe I'm going to ask Timothy to take up Thomas' questions about integration possibly going backwards.
Of course it can go backwards. No alliance, Axis, Concert, Commonwealth, Empire in European history has ever lasted forever. That's simply a historical fact. So probably this one won't either. Do I think the forces of disaggregation are gaining the upper hand at the moment? No, I don't. Absolutely not. I think the issue for the next decade, I mean, there are tests ahead, obviously, particularly in the case of the euro, but if I leave that specific question aside, that the larger question, the institutions of the European Union, I think the real question is, do we remain at roughly this level of integration, where we're a kind of tight commonwealth, yes? Or do we move ahead in certain key areas? And for me, foreign policy is the most important of those, not least because if you look at the opinion polls and if you talk to young Europeans, this is actually one of the things that excites them. They take Europe for granted. What they're excited about is the rest of the world. So if Europe could show that it matters for development in relations with Russia, in relations with China, that would be a motivating force.
Thanks. Ambassador Bruton, the question on commissioners?
Well, every country will now have a commissioner. That's the unanimous agreement among the member states that they will retain this if the Lisbon Treaty comes into force. If the Lisbon Treaty had not come into force, there is a requirement that the number of commissioners would be reduced to below the number of current members.
Okay. Did you have a quick
comment? No.
Okay. Next round of questions. Three questions. Yes, please.
No. Hello, my name is Ava Jones. I'm a recent graduate of American University. My question is about further EU expansion. How does the Lisbon Treaty affect new member states like Croatia wanting to join in their process? Will all new member states be expected to ratify the Lisbon Treaty as a condition of joining?
Thanks. There was a question here. Please, Adriana, there's there.
Hi, my name is Aurea Molto. I'm from Spain. I have a question for Mr. Gartonas. If David Cameron is the next British Prime Minister, and if this referendum takes place, don't you think that the referendum could be seen in Europe and abroad as a referendum of the UK membership to the European Union?
So which referendum?
The Irish.
If David Cameron has this referendum on the Lisbon Treaty, don't that referendum could be seen in Europe and abroad as a referendum on UK membership to the European Union?
Thanks. Mm. And one last question here in the very back. Yes, the gentleman with the long hair.
Oh. Is that a discriminatory?
Hello.
Can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name's Gavin James. I'm a graduate student at Virginia Tech. Some politicians in the UK have suggested that last year's election of members of its far-right BNP to the European Parliament is largely a result of its PR-based voting system. Does the panel believe this to be a valid argument, and what, if anything, should be done to address it?
Thanks. Sorry, would you like to start?
I can take enlargement.
Yes, sure.
Yeah, now, Lisbon is, enlargement policy is schizophrenic because on one side is clearly the most successful aspect of European foreign policy. Mm. But it's also a very political issue. So one of the things which have emerged in the current negotiation is that enlargement will be part of a General Affairs Council, which means it will fall under the responsibility of the EU member states' foreign ministers and not by the high representative ones. So that is one of the things on which the member states were very strong. Now, on the other side, the idea is that the next enlargement will concern the Balkans. And we want to send a strong signal to them. Now, the problem is that on the side of Germany, when you want to say something, they have been a block. They just put a block on Albania. Albania has asked has introduced this request for membership, and now the council should entrust the commission to give its first opinion, which is nothing much. We're just saying that whether it can start thinking about that or not. But that has been blocked by Germany. We have the issue of Croatia, which is the nearest one, and the pending issue there is the question of borders between Slovenia and Croatia. That's a major problem, which are starting to solve. But anyway, if there will be an enlargement, that will be on Croatia. And then next you have Turkey, which of course is a major problem. And one of the reasons our delightful members of the EU General Assembly that I was mentioning to before, don't want to be dismissed, is that they say that Turkey is associated to the WEO, and if you dismiss it, then Turkey will fill in a corner, which is, I mean, a useless discussion. But it's true that we have this question of Turkey. Turkey is different because if Turkey becomes a member, then we'll have to have a referendum in France. And that is, so the question is different. But that being said, nothing much will change. Mm-hmm.
Thanks. Timothy, could you address the question of, you know, will we soon have to say bye-bye Britain from the rest of the continent? And if you could address the last question that was asked as well.
Sure. One word on the enlargement. The strategic issue on enlargement is not the Western Balkans. The strategic issue on enlargement is A, Turkey, B, Ukraine.
Ukraine, yeah.
The Lisbon Treaty does nothing to that directly, but indirectly it does in this sense. If, as a result, in a number of years, Europe is feeling better about itself, more self-confident, and thinking more strategically, then the case for Turkey and Ukraine is strengthened. On the British referendum, so what Cameron says is, we'll have a referendum if the whole thing is not ratified. So the Poles and Czechs have got to sign it fast so it is ratified, and then we won't have a British referendum. Okay, and the Tories will be awkward customers, but I bet you they wouldn't come back and have a referendum on a signed and sealed and ratified treaty. The referendum we should have in Britain, in my view, asks the following question. Do you want Britain to leave the European Union? This would really put the Conservatives and other Eurosceptics on the spot, because this is the question they do not want to answer, right? And one reason why the BNP, this goes to your question at the back, I mean, leave aside the PR question, the BNP and the UK Independence Party is doing so well is because they say clearly, we want out. They pose this question. So I would like to see a referendum in Britain on the question, should Britain leave the European Union? And I think you would find that the majority answer, no. And that would lance the boil that has been festering for the last 30 years.
Though the one time there was a referendum in Britain, whether they want to go to stay or to go out, actually, yes won. You remember that.
No, but I'm sorry, that's what I just said. Yes. Yes would win this time.
Yeah. Ah, okay.
The yes would win.
Charlie,
so yes, we want to stay in.
Okay, yeah. Sorry. Yeah, no, I do agree with you.
Yeah, just Charlie, a quick comment relating this question to the first question about could the EU backslide. And I think I would agree with Tim that it can and that it actually might, in the sense that I think unions past some point at which they become irreversible, past the point of no return, and I don't think that Europe is there yet. And in that respect, I would encourage the EU to begin to think about two things. One is how to deal with spoilers, how to deal with a country that does have a referendum that says, we don't like this anymore, or something of that sort, or the German Constitutional Court. In other words, think to the future of how to preserve what you've got and not let a stinker come along and screw things up. And then the second would be to begin to think in a more articulate and progressive way about what are called coalitions of the willing or reinforced cooperation, particularly on the defense issue. Because I think if Europe moves forward at the wishes of the lowest common denominator, it can write off foreign and security policy. If it says, well, let's let countries that have the capacity and the interest move forward, I'm much more comfortable about where it will be heading.
Thanks.
We have one
last round of questions. You'll have a chance. The panel will.
It's just two technical things. Now, the foreign defense both the foreign policy and defense policy actually foreseen under Lisbon the possibility for a coalition of the willing to go ahead, and that's a major change. So that is something that actually will have be able to happen. And the other thing that Lisbon introduces in this area that we discussed is the fact that for the first time the treaty will actually foreseen the possibility of secession. Whether that will be easier or difficult to be done is questionable. But the current treaty doesn't foresee the possibility for a member state to secede. The only case we had was Greenland, which was technically part of Denmark, and secede. But with the new treaty, that will be at least juridically feasible.
Well, it is always juridically feasible under the Vienna Convention to withdraw from a treaty anyway. Mm-hmm. But it's now explicit.
Exactly. Last round of questions, of three questions. Yes, sir.
My name is Robert Rhodes. I'm from upstate New York. This question pertains to the ratification of the Lisbon Treaty. What does it mean pertaining to Germany, since they, from my understanding, they have three of the top positions mm-hmm. currently in the European Union mm-hmm. versus the European Court of Justice?
Here asks
Garrett,
here. The relations between the German Constitutional Court and the European Union.
Thanks. Gary Mitchell from the Mitchell Report. I want to press a little bit on the forces of aggregation and the forces of renationalization and start by asking Dr. Kupchan whether a semantic question, which is you used the term aggregation as opposed to integration, and I wanted to know whether you see those as interchangeable or whether there's something significant in the choice of the term aggregation that maybe we ought to understand. And second piece of that is, if one doesn't think of it just in terms of the European Union, but thinks of it in terms of challenges to governance, period, everywhere, this is a question to the panel, but it comes from Dr. Kupchan's framework. Is this notion of aggregation versus renationalization the same as or qualitatively different than what we're seeing in this country today, for example, which we use with terms like partisanship and polarization versus bipartisanship?
Interesting. The gentleman just ahead of you.
Thank you. Declan McPartlin is my name. I'm a small-time politician from Ireland. I'm at the county council level. I work with Marion Harkin, who is an MEP, who represents about half the landmass of Ireland, and worked very effectively to deliver a yes vote. Going back to Charlie's point about the likelihood of America to put pressure on the UK on matters of wishing the UK to speak as a unit, including the Britain. While President Obama has in research, elevated the status and the perception of the United States in Europe hugely in just the period in which he was elected. America's the perception of America in most European countries 2 years ago was zilch. Obama has now brought that up to huge levels of his expectation. Why would the panel think that America is yet ready to pressure Britain so that Europe can become a power as strong as America in foreign policy? And bearing in mind that we have a real need to get close to Russia, if for no other reason than their energy sources. Thank you.
Thanks. What I'm going to ask the panelists is maybe to take up the questions that are of interest to them and maybe offer concluding remarks so we can end this. And maybe, Ralph, if you would like to start maybe with the first question that was asked.
Concerning the first question, I'm not an expert in the European law system. I would guess that on the juridical level, you have the same open competition between national legislation and European legislation than you have it on the political level. There is competition between these different juridical systems and organs. And I think this is still a process in the making. If finally European law will trump over the constitutional law of the states, but now it's not the case because when it comes again to John Bruton's argument that basically we still have sovereignty of states, and so a strong influence of national constitutional law on European decisions. But for me, it's difficult to give a clear-cut answer to that question. And last remark, I would not go so far to see the European Union as a global actor in the same way and with the same powerful impact than the United States because of the very different internal composition of the European Union. But I agree very much that willingness, the political will to act globally as a European player vis-a-vis the United States, whether it be China or the Russia and the other upcoming emerging countries, will widely define the future of the European Union.
Thanks. Thanks, Ralph. Fed?
Yeah, a quick comment on foreign policy and the U.S. Now, Lisbon Treaty, on the one side, clearly states that the European foreign policy is not going to affect the national foreign policy. But now, I mean, going back to what Charlie said, I completely agree with the fact that I really hope that Obama will make it clear to the British, sorry, to what Timothy said, that will make it clear to the British that he wants Europe. But even if he doesn't it in so loud terms, this is a reality what is happening today already. I mean, look at the dynamics between G8 and G20. You know, G20 is replacing G8 because G8 didn't make sense. You had, what, 4 fighting Europeans sitting at the table and a few others. That was ridiculous. You know, I know that if this is read in Italy, they will scream because they're among those who say, oh, no, we still want the G8. You know, there was this meeting organized by Almunia, the European Commissioner, before Pittsburgh with the permanent representative in Brussels. And he said, oh, you know, I'm going to Pittsburgh tomorrow and there is no sign we're going to move to the G20. Hello, where are you living? You know, it's Iran is going to become a bilateral issue with the U.S. I mean, it's very clear that this president is thinking that either Europe wakes up and acts on as one or it will lose completely its own influence. Mm-hmm. It's in the X. So in Italian we have this say, il bisognino fa correre la vecchina. When an old woman needs to go to a toilet, she will raise up and run. I think that will happen with the EU, because this president is not caring about the petty disputes about Europe, about Europeans. Point.
Thanks. Ambassador Bruton?
The first thing I'd say is I think the challenges to governance in the United States that we saw during August at the town hall meetings isn't something that I think is happening in Europe in the same fashion at all. It is true that Europeans are cynical about politicians, but I don't think there is a sort of aggression and indeed questioning of the legitimacy of Washington, for example. The fact that you almost have to condemn Washington to be elected to Washington is something that I don't think you would see in the politics of a European country. To come to the question of the country I know second best in the European Union, my immediate neighbour, the United Kingdom, I think it's first thing to say is obviously integration in the European Union is particularly difficult for a country that is itself a union of nations. And there are, as we know, four nations that constitute the United Kingdom. I think, and I have obviously direct experience of working in the European Council and in councils of ministers with British ministers. And I think you see in the British approach to problems a reflection of the difference between Anglo-Saxon legal thinking and continental legal thinking. Anglo-Saxon legal thinking focuses on pragmatic solutions to problems. It is a case-by-case approach. Whereas on the continent, and this is the predominant approach in Europe, one tries to set out general principles and then one works down to the practical from the general principle. And I think one of the reasons why the UK has perfectly understandable problems with the European Union is that the European Union has this general principles approach. But when it comes to the practice, one finds that British ministers are more than willing to reach compromises, and that Britain is exceptionally loyal in the implementation of EU legislation once it has agreed to it. Mm-hmm. As to whether President Obama, answer Councillor McPartland's question, whether President Obama is likely to be wanting to put pressure on Britain, I think the reaction that Britain would likely find would be one of pragmatism. If they see an issue where they feel that a European approach can add value to the solution of the problem, I don't see Britain or British politicians have any difficulty with that. If, on the other hand, they're asked to accept a general proposition that in foreign policy you must always subsume your policy in the European one, they won't accept that. But I think there's more than one way of reaching the destination. And I think one must rejoice in the diversity and the particularities that make up the European Union. And the United Kingdom is a very good example of that.
Timothy.
Thank you for that. To the Chancellor, the American interest, it seems to me quite clearly, is that in a century that will be increasingly dominated by non-European giants, you obviously want a strong partner on the continent, which clearly to a very large degree shares your values and shares your interests. Americans are not from Mars, Europeans are not from Venus. In fact, with Obama, we're all Venusians now. As for Britain, I do see a danger, to go to what Ambassador Bruton just said, of a little too much short-term pragmatism on the part of the Obama administration. It seems to me they have a very pragmatic issue-by-issue can-do approach. What can you do for us today on Afghanistan or Pakistan or whatever it might be? If you have too much of that, then you say, well, the reality today is we have to go to London, we have to go to Paris, we have to go to Berlin, we have to go to the national capitals. So I would want him to keep in mind a bit more the strategic perspective for the United States over the next 5 to 10 years, which I think is to try to encourage Europe to speak with one voice. American policy, American attitudes have always been a very important catalyst of European integration, and I hope they will remain so.
Thanks. Last word for you again, Charlie.
I think that I chose the word aggregation quite self-consciously in the sense that it seems to me there's a sequential process that goes on. The unions integrate, and then they get to a point where they start to aggregate. And I think Europe on the economic front has aggregated. So it does hold sway globally in a way that's commensurate with its aggregate GDP and population, but it hasn't begun to move in that direction geopolitically. And I think one of the questions this panel has been debating is Lisbon going to begin to enable it to aggregate? And I think the panel has basically said, we don't have any idea. The other issue, which is a very interesting question, and that is the renationalization that we've been talking about part of a broader phenomenon that is also taking place in this country? And I think I would disagree a little bit with John here and say I think that the governability crisis that has affected the United States is coming to Europe, and that I see, for example, the trends that Ralph talked about in the German elections is indicative that the main parties, the consensus-oriented Germany, is beginning to give way to a more fragmented political landscape. And so sort of gazing into my crystal ball, I think the big challenges of this coming decade are largely going to be governability ones. And if I sort of say, well, what's going to really trip up Obama? I don't think it's going to be that the Kremlin doesn't want to do arms control with us. I think it's going to be that we will do arms control and we'll go to the Senate, and two-thirds of the Senate is not going to ratify it. And Obama will go and say, I want the CTBT, and the Senate will tell him to take a hike. And so I think getting the foreign policies in sync with a very difficult domestic scene is going to be the big story of the coming decade.
Excellent. That concludes the session. Please join me in thanking all the panelists for their great work.